Welcome to the Insightful Investor Podcast, a weekly series that seeks to share industry, investment, and market insights. We define insights as concepts that are counterintuitive, widely misunderstood, or underappreciated. In other words, unique ideas that you probably won't hear elsewhere. I'm Alex Shahidi, the host of the podcast and co-CIO of Evoke Advisors, one of the nation's leading investment advisory firms. Learn more about our show at insightfulinvestor.org. Today's guest is David Samrat. David is the managing director of Artisan Partners and the founding partner of the Artisan International Value Team. He's also the lead portfolio manager of the strategy since its inception in 2002. David and his team manage about $40 billion of the firm's $160 billion. David, thank you for joining me today.
Well, thank you for having me, Alex.
David, you've been investing for over 30 years. Would you start with your background and how you originally got into investing?
Well, I think similar to today and all the way through history, education is the source of social mobility. And it was for me, having grown up in a blue-collar family. I was in an undergraduate program that offered really just two majors, accounting and finance. And it was obvious to me that finance seemed to be a better road to social mobility than accounting. Accounting was just fine, very safe, but finance was far more interesting. And after having gone through a security analysis class, I instantly fell in love with the stock market and focused my efforts since then on a career in investing. And that's really the history. You know, I bought my first security and, you know, luckily made some money on it and thought that, wow, I didn't have to bang a nail or pick up a hammer or do anything physical and really didn't have to do anything at all. And I thought, I had discovered, the road to riches. And, I have to say that over the years, although this isn't, part of the way that I got involved, but over the years, what I've discovered is the main gratification of doing this is your ability to create wealth for your shareholders, and the shareholders being across the spectrum, endowments, hospitals that are taking care of patients, art institutes that are, buying art and displaying it out for the public. It's charities that are helping people pay for their kids' college education, helping individuals retire. That is actually the most gratifying part of the job.
Are there lessons you learned early in your career that helped shape the investor you are today? Perhaps some painful lessons. Oftentimes we learn more from our mistakes than we learn from our successes. That maybe painful lessons that permanently change the way you think about investing.
There are a lot of lessons learned along the way in terms of understanding the difference between a good business and a bad business, good management team and a bad management team, and a good risk reward versus a bad risk reward. And that really comes with cumulative knowledge and practice. Prior to going to graduate school, which I did at Columbia Business School, which is the center for value investing, I believe, in this country, I had a small partnership in place with a few other my friends, and one of them had decided that he would try to trade options. We didn't really understand what he was doing, And turned out neither did he. And we ended up losing a fair amount of money on that. So, you know, the key lesson there is make sure that you have a deep understanding of what you're involved in and what the risks are versus the potential reward before you start allocating your capital.
And I guess sometimes you may feel like you have a deep understanding, but your assessment of that is not accurate.
Well, the world obviously is variable. Human beings are variable, and it doesn't operate in a straight line. And you know, you can do serious amounts of due diligence with very intelligent people looking at all aspects of a business that you're investing in, and you know, things change. You know, you do a lot of due diligence on a management team, and you find a CEO who is great at capital allocation who goes out and does a bad deal. You know, politicians, the government can wake up one day and change the rules. You know, so the key there, Alex, that we've found is, and I'm sort of stealing this from a friend of mine, is you always want to be strong money. You never want to find yourself in a position where the world changes or something changes inside a business or with yourself as an investor, where you don't have the capital to be able to weather through a situation like that. And, you know, we as value investors have an obligation to think through issues, right? Because there are two fundamental concepts in value investing. Of course, the main driver is to generate excess returns. That is the core directive of value investing. But the second is to manage risk. And there are many components to risk management, and we can talk about them as we discuss the type of securities that we like and we don't like. But you have to have both of those objectives in mind. And one of the tools that we have in order to do that is to ensure that we always have financial strength.
That makes sense. One of the things that I think is pretty fascinating about our industry is anybody can pick stocks, but picking securities well is quite challenging. There's obviously complexity. There's randomness. There are a lot of things that are just inherently unpredictable. What do you think it is that allows you to pick securities well? And what is it about this industry that is just so challenging to do what you do so well?
You know, a lot of this industry, the industry is populated with what I call products. You know, large institutions like BlackRock, not to pick them out specifically, but generally speaking, the industry is out there selling all sorts of products, a lot of them unthinking products, you know, ETFs that are industry-based. And unfortunately, I think for the consumer of these products, it tends to dumb down and tries to almost commoditize what they're doing with their money. All value in the world is created through commerce. And, you know, there is speculation, right? There's Bitcoin or gold or other forms of speculation, but all value over the long term is created by commerce. As Amazon gets bigger and generates more profits, it becomes more valuable. And that's how, and again, I'm not specifically picking on Amazon, but just to make a point. So I think that is the first item to recognize in your effort to be an investor. And then, okay, so all value is created by commerce. How do I make sure that I invest at a point in time in the proper company and at the right price? And that's where the hard work comes in. There are tens of thousands of equities listed across the globe, and you have to have some sort of framework that you use to put yourself in a position where you're invested in a business that will create value over time, that you understand enough about that business to ensure the value will be created, right? That's a lot of homework. And third, you have to be patient enough to wait for the right price to pay for that business to ensure that you know, you don't overpay where the value that commerce creates is already eaten up by the fact that you've overpaid for that value. You know, that's the framework that we use, generally speaking, to invest capital on behalf of shareholders. And therein lies the difference between a product and an investment platform. Our objective is to create wealth. Our customers over time should have more purchasing power in the future than they have today. And that's our general objective and our general ambition. And it's that simple. It's not trading in and out of a vehicle. It's not speculating on one thing or another, but finding the proper business at the right price and allowing that commerce to create enough value to improve the purchasing power of our investors.
In my experience, talking to people getting into the industry, there's a natural tendency to focus on the companies that have rising prices. Yet, you know, as opposed to companies that are facing price pressure, you have a slightly different orientation. I heard you in another podcast talk about your initial inclination was to look at companies where the price was falling because there's more likelihood to find value there. Do you feel like that's something that you were born with, meaning you were born a value investor, or was there something that pulled you in that direction?
Well, I really do think it takes a certain human being to be a value investor. You know, over the years, we get approached by, of course, the sell side or broker dealers who want to assist us so they can generate commissions. And I've never gotten an idea from a broker dealer over the course of my career. And what I always say to a new relationship there that, look, you know, we'd be happy to have a relationship with you, but you need to know that every time you show me a stock where the share price is going up, it's probably unlikely we're going to do anything. And my guess is that you'll never, ever show us a stock where the price is going down. You know, the value of a business is the present value of its future cash flows. And if you have smart, diligent people and decent disclosure behind the asset, you should be able to, within the realm of reason, come to some estimate of, you know, roughly what the business is worth. And, you know, the stock market moves around it, gyrates around that price. And during times of stress, market psychology, which is the second aspect of what drives the stock market, it kicks in, and it kicks in very aggressively. And share prices can fall well below any reasonable estimate of long-term intrinsic value for a decent amount of time. And that puts you in a place where you can generate significant excess returns and also accomplish the second component of value investing, which we talked about earlier, which is avoiding a permanent loss of capital. And it really is a unique and special characteristic of the stock market that allows you to do that. There aren't, you know, most investors will look at a company and say, wow, this is a great business and it's going to, you know, it's going to create a lot of value over time, so I'm willing to pay a fair price. And, you know, if you truly do have a compounder and you have a lot of trust and confidence in what the future is going to look like for that compounder, that's a great way to make money. We attempt to take it one step further and say, wow, look, we found this great business and it should add a lot of value over time. But lo and behold, because of the delicate nature of the stock market and the psychological inputs that go along with money, we're able to not only own a piece of this fabulous company, but we're able to own it at a price that puts us in a place to make a spectacular return. And if things go wrong, you know, we've minimized our risk. You know, I always say to my clients, I don't know why you would ever put your money in private equity. You know, you have usually a knowledgeable seller doing a deal with a knowledgeable buyer, which means that, you know, the only way that they're going to add value to that is to leverage it up in some way to extract value. And if you're really interested in taking on the risk of leverage, you could always invest alongside us and leverage up your investment. And on top of that, you get the added benefit that a lot of the sellers in the stock market are completely uninformed. And that just doesn't exist in private equity.
On that point, I'm curious about your thoughts about market efficiency, but obviously in public markets. How do you think about that?
Certainly, the market's more efficient than it was 30 years ago when I got involved. And because I invest outside the United States, the markets outside the US 30 years ago were very inefficient, mainly because information simply wasn't available. You had to get on an airplane and you had to go, and all the financial statements and disclosures, which were sparse back then, were in foreign language. The reporting frequencies were very low, and corporate governance standards and structures were pretty bad for somebody who is a minority shareholder. Now, that's changed. And so what that means is a company like Hermes or LVMH or L'Oreal, or, you know, take your popular company these days, you know, they'll trade at valuations that reflect the strong financial characteristics and the bright outlook for the future of those companies. They'll trade at much, much higher multiples than they used to back then. And, you know, issues and opportunities travel through the market much more quickly than they used to. In that sense, the market has become very efficient. On the other hand, you know, I could give you several examples of where the market continues to be inefficient. And it really comes back to what you said, Alex, which is, you know, it takes a certain type of human being to run towards a problem, you know, where the share price is going down, where there's some sort of issue. It's generally there where people have an aversion to bad news, where you find these, you know, inefficient opportunities. One recent example of that was last year, about this time, when, you know, Credit Suisse had slipped on a banana peel, so to speak, and effectively lost the trust and confidence of its lenders, and was, you know, forced into insolvency. And UBS came to the rescue. And UBS is a company that we were a shareholder of, a smaller shareholder at that time. And you could instantly recognize the value of the value created through that transaction. It was a very interesting transaction in the sense that most corporate acquisitions, you know, they're done at fair prices. And, you know, companies have to work hard to get synergies to create any value. This transaction was born out of desperation on the part of basically the Swiss government to find a way to keep this institution from dissolving, and the risk associated with that. And as a result, UBS, and you could see the numbers, they paid roughly $3 billion for $30 billion in assets. Wasn't hard to see. Now, there are going to be restructuring charges and some asset write-downs So let's say they create $25 billion of value, which was roughly at the time about 40 or 50% of the market cap. And the share price went down that day, right? So, you know, you got a lot of bad news. Credit Suisse is going bust. Credit Suisse has been a problematic company for 10 years. And so the headlines just keep pouring out. And most people have very simple reaction to negative headlines, which is, geez, you know, I don't even want to be involved with that. Or if I am, and now UBS is going to buy this problem asset, I definitely don't want to be involved with that. Whereas as a value investor, we focus on the facts and circumstances. Hey, you know, how much are we paying? What are we getting in return? Do we have the capital and the people and the capability in order to manage this? Right. And, you know, in our view, because we knew the people that were involved and we knew these two institutions, in our view, they did have the ability to do that. And the value that was being created was absolutely enormous. And anybody could see it. Right. All the numbers are out there on the table for anybody to look at in the same way that we looked at it. And yet the share price declined when clearly there was value created. So in that sense, that's a really good example of how, you know, and it took really sort of 9 months before the market started to recognize it. And so right there through that set of circumstances, you can see how the market can be very inefficient. It's way harder than it used to be.
I'm sure. I suppose the other way to think about it is, information is more readily available. And so the markets are more efficient in that regard. Yet the people trading, humans, they're not that different today than they were 30 years ago. They're still, you know, decisions are driven by fear and greed, right?
The people trading are not necessarily humans anymore, right? There's a lot of ETFs and structures that are just making trades based on the needs of the product that they're selling. And they're not paying attention to the underlying value of what they're buying or selling. They're really reflecting the flows that are going in and out of these products and then executing on an algorithm that is buying or selling with having zero understanding of the value of what they're buying and selling. And so that, in some sense, is also driving inefficiency in the stock market.
And it's interesting because that has increased with time as index investing, ETFs, mutual funds that track an index, managers who are focused on minimizing their tracking error relative to an index, they all, you know, kind of move in the same direction.
There's also one thing that very few people talk about. It's just like the general level of liquidity. You know, we went through a decade of, you know, interest rates below zero and central banks, especially over the COVID time period, printing a lot of money. So there's just a lot more money out there in the world. And it's found itself in all sorts of places out there in the world. And one of the places it's found itself is in the stock market. So there's just a lot of money around. You could see it as several companies having $1 trillion plus market values. These numbers are mind-boggling, right? They're just absolutely enormous. When I started 30 years ago, if a company was doing an IPO, you know, $500 million was a lot of money to raise. And now, you know, these IPOs are in the billions.
With respect to market efficiency and the points that you made, how do you think about index investing? There's a lot of money that just goes into buying the index with this philosophy that the index reflects all known public information and also the consensus view of what the future holds. Is there something about, let's say, the value index that is just really inefficient and I guess in some ways relatively easy to outperform? How do you think about that?
I looked at that value index when I started here at Artisan 20 years ago, and it was filled with banks and oil companies. And I thought, well, why would anybody want to, you know, invest, you know, more or less most of their money in banks and oil companies? It didn't make any sense. I think a broad-based index for comparison purposes, right? Am I doing a good job? Am I providing my shareholders with a return in excess of what they could get just from investing in an index, and you want something that's broad based. In fact, because we have the flexibility to invest in emerging markets, we actually added an index on top of the broad based index that we use to broaden it out even more to include emerging markets, which have done better over time than the European and the Japanese markets. So we actually made it harder on ourselves than you know, I could certainly do better over time than banks and oil companies. And there's nothing wrong with them. I mean, we've invested, you know, during certain periods of time in certain institutions that we think are fantastic, and we're able to get them at the right prices in those industries. But I certainly wouldn't want to have my entire portfolio and assets like that just because they don't compound over time. I think that if you are a saver, generally speaking, and you would like to have the ability to get exposure to commerce to drive value over time, but you have no knowledge or interest in getting to know managers who can help you, then an index is certainly, a broad-based index is certainly an excellent alternative to, you know, taking the risk. You can use services like Morningstar, you know, that rank managers, but really taking the time out to study a manager and look at their performance over time and reading what they say in their shareholder letters, I think is an important aspect of trying to find somebody who, you know, has the same disposition that you do as an investor. You know, is it an aggressive growth stock investor, or is it a value investor, or a momentum investor? You know, something that reflects the way that you like and feel comfortable doing things. But outside, if you don't have the interest or the ability, you know, you're better off indexing your capital than trying to select a manager.
I know you focus on international. It is interesting when you look at the data going back a couple decades. U.S. has pretty materially outperformed international. Is there any reason to think that there's a structural reason for that to continue, or do you expect that to mean revert over time where these markets get you similar returns through time?
Well, the U.S. is obviously a pretty unique place. We have 330 million wealthy people. We operate in one country with one language, one legal system, very few barriers from state to state. So you can apply commerce across the entire country without a lot of issues keeping you from doing that. And remember, our industrial base was gutted decades ago. It's starting to come back a little bit now, but it was basically gutted, leaving us with an economy that is innovation driven, right? A lot of technology and healthcare and services, which are by their very nature, high return on capital, faster growing industries. And as a result, you know, we also have, which is somewhat unique around the globe, a very robust venture capital, private equity, and stronger capital markets. I mean, people save in their 401ks or their IRAs or their general brokerage accounts and are willing to take risk with their capital. That's not the same everywhere in the world. In most of the markets that I invest in outside the United States, the largest capital pool comes from U.S. investors buying equities in those markets. When you look outside the U.S., you just don't have, you know, Europe, even though they've tried through economic union to, you know, pull themselves together, it's still really just a number of countries with different cultures, language barriers, legal barriers, political barriers to doing business across the continent. And of course, now with Brexit, the UK has moved out of that system. Japan you know, has 150 million what used to be wealthy people, but, you know, very different culture and a government that was sort of hell-bent on generating inflation ended up impoverishing their population slowly but surely. So they're out of the game now. They've got so much debt to GDP, it's unlikely to, you know, turn into the same dynamic that the U.S. has. There's also, you know, social structures and legal labor-related structures that make it very hard for that economy to have, and also immigration structures that make it hard for that economy to have the same sort of dynamism. The one hope that was out there for a long time was China. You know, a billion people, one country, more or less one language, one legal structure that has a lot to be desired, to say the least. And they, in China, had developed a great venture capital and private equity industries there. And for a while, until the current administration came in under Xi Jinping and sort of started going backwards too aggressively, you know, China had the promise of turning into something that challenged the economic system here in the United States. So as a result, you've got, you know, sort of industries that are older, more capital intensive, lower return on capital, slower growth economies. And so I think that the U.S., you know, should, you know, all else equal, you know, you have periods of overvaluation and undervaluation, but all else equal, the U.S. should economically continue to outperform the rest of the world. Now, luckily for us, you know, the nature of the business, there just aren't that many great businesses outside the United States. I'm not saying there aren't any, but there just aren't that many. And that really does lend itself to value investing. And so the universe for us over the last 20 years here at Artisan has been incredibly robust. You know, companies, you know, that are slower growing, but maybe great businesses, they have issues here and there, and valuations get very, very attractive. You know, and for people like us that have a very distinct value strategy, it creates tremendous opportunity. It's hard to be a growth stock investor outside the US. That's a tough place to be.
Well, would you just talk about your general approach to value investing? Obviously, you want to buy, you know, good businesses with good management teams, strong balance sheets at a discount to intrinsic value. Is there more insight you can share about how you do that really well that maybe the market isn't properly discounting?
Well, I think that, you know, stating that construct, you know, an undervalued company that's a good business with a strong balance sheet and a good management team, stating those is very simple. Finding those in combination is like finding a needle in a haystack. It's very, very difficult. And, you know, you're, as a value investor, we don't compromise on buying an undervalued security. That's where we generate our excess returns, and that's how we manage risk. But you're going to find that some businesses are better than others, some balance sheets are stronger than others, and some management teams are better than others. And you're always, as you go through your fundamental homework to look at the nature of the business and assess those characteristics, you're always lining up valuation relative to those other characteristics and finding that proper mix between the right price for the type of business, its underlying growth rate, its return on capital, its cash flow generation capability, the quality of the management team, the nature of the corporate governance of that company, and getting that balance between quality of business and valuation correct is what makes a difference between one investor and another investor. And really, that goes back to what we talked about earlier. That's all cumulative knowledge build, right? That's being in the markets for many years, watching businesses, watching them operate, how they create value, watching management teams, looking at corporate governance structures and incentive systems and what is effective in creating value and what structures impede the creation of value. And so experience is very, very important. Experience and discipline.
One of the things you just said, I think, is absolutely critical, and a lot of people may not emphasize it as much as you did, which is it's all about price. That's the one thing you don't compromise on, because it helps you not only on the return side, but also to help manage risk, which is, you know, the dual mandate. And if you could just talk about that a little bit more, because I think it's so critical, and I think a lot of people have just missed that part.
Yeah, it gets lost in a lot of dialogue, you know, because it's very seductive to talk about a business and how great it is, right? And especially, you know, for a company like NVIDIA or whatever is the most popular company out in the market, people just want to be associated with success. And it's very easy to be associated with success. You just open up a brokerage account and boom, you're in. But if that success comes at a price that's too high, you put yourself in the potential position for a permanent loss of capital. And there are many examples, you know, over the years. We had the tech bubble, and we may have another one now, although this one is better based on fundamentals than the last one. But for us, it's exactly the opposite. Let's start with the price, right? Let's start with the valuation. Here's a group of securities that look like they're trading at reasonable to cheap multiples. And then let's go in from there and start eliminating the bad businesses. Let's eliminate the bad balance sheets. Let's eliminate the incentive structures and the corporate structures that will work against us as shareholders. And then let's look at the management team and see how well they've executed over time. And let's take a look at the decisions that they've made. Are these people that we really want to be involved in? But the excess return really comes from buying a company that's worth $30 at $20. And not only do you have, let's say, a great business that's growing at 10% a year. So if you start out and it's worth 30 and a year goes by, now it's worth 33 and another year goes by, now it's worth 37, 38, right? And because you bought it at 20, you not only capture the unwind of the discount from 20 to 30, but you also capture that underlying growth and the value of the business. It's a spectacular way of generating returns. And then, of course, if something goes wrong and $30 turns out to be $25, because you've purchased that equity at $20 per share, you've avoided a permanent loss of capital. And again, it's easy to delineate the way that value investing works. The hard part is finding the exact right risk reward and security-based situations that reflect those underlying characteristics.
I'm curious if the market is, let's say, relatively efficient. How do you find good businesses, good management, good, you know, balance sheet at a discount? Is it largely because the market participants are uninformed or overly emotional at times? Is that what allows you to buy at that discount?
At the scale that we operate in, generally speaking, there's some sort of issue that drives a security down to a valuation that's attractive. So one recent example was during the pandemic, and you had basically two categories of assets that were sold off aggressively. One was anything in travel and leisure, and then there was oil and gas. And oil and gas generally is a soft cyclical. Right. If the economy gets difficult, people will drive a little bit less. But if everybody's locked up in their house and not allowed to drive, then you're going to get a lot less demand for that commodity. And I don't know if you remember this, but at the onset of the pandemic, there was actually a price war that was being executed between Russia and Saudi Arabia. So not only was demand sinking, but they were actually pumping out a lot more oil, increasing supply at the same time. And so the price of a barrel of oil fell well below the marginal cost of production. Now, in each of these areas, there are going to be good businesses and bad businesses. For example, generally speaking, airlines are bad businesses. But there is one airline in Europe that's run extremely well. It's called Ryanair. And not only is it run very well, but also is constructed financially very conservative. They own all their airplanes and they run with no debt on the balance sheet. So if any company was going to survive a couple of years of lockdown, it was going to be Ryanair. And if you compare it to its competitors, lease many of their airplanes and generally carried very high levels of debt and were in a very weakened position, right? So the management of Ryanair, which is excellent, you know, could go over to Boeing, which was also suffering, and for a very good price, put in an order for a large number of aircraft. Why? Because they had the cash to be able to make a deposit. And as their competitors were backing off from airport slots because, you know, they were running at a loss, Ryanair could go in and fill those slots and make it through the downturn, right? So there, you know, even though the airline industry is a bad industry, generally speaking, you know, there are quality companies there. Or another quality company is Safran that makes narrow body engines, also very well capitalized. In oil and gas, you know, Schlumberger is a great, well-managed, and probably the best oil services company in the world with a very strong balance sheet. Imperial Oil in Canada is a subsidiary of Exxon, which had a AAA balance sheet, which became available at a handout price, right? So, you know, we're not going in willy-nilly during these time periods and just buying things, but we're going in selectively and trying to find the great businesses that are being sold to us at a cheap price. And then there are companies that just have an idiosyncratic issue. You know, a management team goes out and does a bad deal. You know, there's a new management team, or a company is undermanaged for many years, you know, where they're operating at margins that are below the level of most of its competitors, many of its competitors. And then a new management team comes in, or the board turns over and the goals and objectives of the company are changed, right? And oftentimes that creates an opportunity to get involved with a company whose, you know, operating profitability is below where it should be. And if the management team executes, that profitability be much higher, which would make the valuation much less expensive. And so, you know, there are lots of different reasons why you might find a company that's mispriced. But oftentimes it comes when there's some sort of, you know, calamity out in the world.
You know, managers typically go through stretches of underperformance. And what I've experienced is they tend to attribute skill to the periods of outperformance and then bad luck to the periods of underperformance. How does one objectively assess whether they're underperforming because the market just has it wrong or whether they actually have it wrong? How do you think about that?
First, I think there's skill in underperforming too. You know, skill is not, you know, doesn't have a monopoly on outperformance. And we've had our fair share of both. So for us, if you bring it down to the security level, which is the way that we think about the world, you know, oftentimes we'll own a business and management's doing a good job creating value and the market's off focused on something else. And so that's one way you can underperform. Another way you can underperform is having, a series of assets where you've misanalyzed or you've misjudged, either the people running the business or the real quality of the business, or something's changed out in the world. The pace of innovation these days is very fast, and assessing whether or not those innovations are going to help your company or hurt your company is much more complicated than it used to be. And so the types of tools that we need, the sophistication of the analysts that we have and their ability to understand how changes in the world may impact a business that you own is very important. And so for us, it really comes down to the security level. Are these businesses continuing to add value? And even if we have a flat underlying share price, get back to our early example where the company's growing at 10% a year from 30 to 37 over a couple of years, and you bought the share price at 20 and it continues to trade sideways at 20, as long as that company is adding value, we're happy to own the security. And as it gets more undervalued, we're more likely to buy more of that security rather than just sit on it. And so, it really comes down to the manager's responsibility to take a look at the securities that they own and make a distinction between what has happened with price versus what has happened fundamentally with the underlying value of the businesses that they own. And that's the only way that I can reasonably analyze periods of underperformance.
It's easier to, I guess, in some sense, predict the fundamentals than it is what the market's price on that is going to be. Because you could go through long stretches where you could be correct fundamentally, but the market for some reason doesn't recognize that value or just doesn't see what you see. And that could go for years.
It can, and we wouldn't care. We would just keep doing what we're doing. We want to put our shareholders in a position where we're not getting them involved in speculation in any way, shape, or form based on some market fad or some market trend, that they continue to be invested in good businesses at proper valuations. And, if the market wants to do something insane for a little while, so be it.
Now, obviously, that's something you can't control, but what you can control is your analysis and buying companies at a good price with the confidence that works out over time.
We have to make sure that we're diligent about the fundamental homework that we do about our businesses. And as long as we continue to be diligent about that, we should put our shareholders in a position to prosper.
There's always a concern about the quote unquote value trap. How do you think about that and how do you avoid that?
It really comes down to, those four characteristics that you identified earlier. One of them is great business. And as long as you have a good business that has high returns and a management team that knows how to allocate capital, they should be able to create value over time. And that's effectively what avoids value traps. It's the reason why, we manage a pretty focused portfolio. Half of our assets are roughly in the top 10 securities. Like I said, this is needle in a haystack investing. It's very hard to find securities that fit that profile. And once we do, we want to make sure that we invest significantly behind them. And that helps us avoid value traps.
How do you think about the risk of remaining dogmatic in your approach and potentially gradually losing your edge as the market starts to invest similarly and price similarly with that same insight? How do you think about just the longevity of the approach and adapting to the shift in environment?
Historically, we have been adaptive, right? Like I said earlier, 30 years ago, all you needed to do was go and get the information because nobody else was doing it. And once you had the information, you could identify an undervalued security, you were able to generate very good returns. And then over time, as capital markets started to develop outside the United States, it became much more competitive and we had to turn into true securities analysts. And we were still operating with relatively small amounts of capital. And now, you know, with $40 billion under management, you know, the universe which we can look at is smaller, and the law of large numbers is working against us. And so the tools that we've had to develop in our tool chest to allow us to generate returns and the way that we approach investing has had to evolve. Now, we haven't changed our philosophy a bit. We're still looking for those same four key characteristics, but how those returns are generated and the inputs that we have in that process has changed over time. I think it's important to recognize that, you know, the world's not static. It changes. And, you know, we have now artificial intelligence, you know, sort of creeping up around us that have the potential. And I'm not saying it's going to change everything, but it has the potential to change a lot of things. And, you know, we have to be focused and we have to be aware of that. But the general approach doesn't change. The value of the business is the present value of its future cash flows. The hard part is estimating those future cash flows and getting them right. So our approach of paying a price that's well below the value of those future cash flows never really needs to change. What may need to change is, you know, our assessment of those future cash flows. And that's where, you know, you may suffer some impairment if you cease to have an understanding of, you know, the proper economics that are taking place in the world.
Do you sometimes run into issues of finding enough companies where you're not overly concentrated and therefore you have to relax some of the standards? How do you balance between those two interests?
We never relax our standards. And so there are certain stock market environments, and today is one of them, you know, where it's very, very difficult, given higher multiples, to find companies that fit our profile. And so what we do is we, as companies hit our estimates of intrinsic value, you know, we're selling them off, and we pile up cash, and we're happy to hold cash during time periods where, you know, eventually, slowly but surely, we'll get, you know, that capital reinvested. But generally during time periods of buoyant stock markets, we find ourselves in a position where it's easy to find companies in the portfolio that are at or well above our estimates of intrinsic value, but very hard to find ways to redeploy that capital very quickly.
That makes sense. There are a lot of value investors out there, and I understand you don't get to sit in the room when they're doing their analysis. But is there anything you can share in terms of common mistakes that other value investors make that you try to avoid?
Generally speaking, I find value investors as a group to be very intelligent allocators of capital. I think that there are certain characteristics of the traditional sort of Ben Graham approach to value investing that we have tried to modify, you know, just looking at a very diversified portfolio of securities that are trading at statistically cheap multiples puts you in a position potentially to end up with a group of securities that are what you referred to as value traps. And I also think that you end up with companies that are financially leveraged, right? Because companies that have a lot of leverage are inherently leveraged, like banks, tend to trade at lower multiples. And so you end up sort of being exposed to either lower quality businesses or businesses that have more leverage than I would think is prudent. And so we've tried to take that traditional approach to value investing and focus on, you know, better businesses with strong balance sheets and good management teams, which again, then takes the portfolio from being very diversified into one that's pretty focused, just because, you know, finding those businesses is much more difficult.
You alluded to managing risk earlier, but let's dive in a little bit more. How do you think about risk? Is it risk of loss, risk of permanent impairment of capital. A lot of investors think of the risk of underperforming the index. How do you think about risk?
Yeah, we never think of risk of underperforming the index. When you work hard for your money, right, and all of our investors have, you know, you work your whole life and you have your life. You only have really one life to earn, right? And when you contextualize what you're doing and how important it is to preserve that capital, when you think about investing the incremental dollar, risk is primary in your thought process. And when we put together our philosophy and our strategy and we started executing on it, risk was in our mind as part of the reason why we took the traditional approach to value investing and we thought about it a little bit more and said, okay, if we're going to be buying an undervalued security, we get both the return generation and expected return, but how can we add some insurance policies to this? So if we own a good business and it has the ability to grow over time, you're likely, as you wait for your company to revalue, you're likely to avoid purchasing power erosion from the ever presence of inflation, right? So that's one way that we thought through risk management. The second way we thought through risk management is if we own a business and if it's having a problem, we want to make sure that there's a strong balance sheet behind it so that management teams can properly reinvest back in the business, restore its operating strength, and have the capability to deal with any unforeseen issues, you know, like some sort of recession. So that's the second way we thought of managing risk. And the third way is by having a great management team in place that's focused on the right things. And that's not easy. In this world, there are a lot of corporations who have bad incentive structures or the management team's not that good or are not focused on the right things. But by having the right management team in place, you get them focused on the right things so they don't destroy value, right? And these are all insurance policies that we put in place to try to avoid a permanent loss of capital. What we have found, Alex, just to take it to the next step, is that these factors in combination can be a very powerful driver of returns. So if you have a fundamentally a good business and you have excess capital in the hands of an excellent management team that knows how to allocate capital, they can very rapidly create value in ways that you just can't put, you know, in a spreadsheet.
And I suppose on the other end of the spectrum, internationally, you deal with state-owned enterprises in some cases where they may not prioritize shareholders in the governance. I guess the question there is that already in the price or do you look past that and just typically avoid those organizations?
It's the latter. Governments oftentimes have objectives that are different than our objectives and what we need for our shareholders. And, there's just an obvious clash there. And in democratic countries, you have regimes, you have leadership that changes periodically. And even if you have one group of leaders that, you know, take a constructive attitude towards a state-owned enterprise, in a few years' time, you may have, you know, new leadership that has a different attitude. And so generally speaking, you know, we avoid investment in state-owned enterprises. And that's a good chunk of emerging markets. A lot of, you know, emerging markets, market cap is tied up into these large state-owned enterprises. And oftentimes it's necessary for those countries to do what they need to do in order to grow. So, you know, there's no there's no negative view of what's going on. It's just not consistent with what we're trying to accomplish.
I think it would be helpful if you can just share some general advice for the individual investors out there, many of whom are picking stocks themselves. They probably enjoyed a pretty good run as you've had this bull market, particularly in the US. Is there any general advice you have in terms of the challenges of maintaining, you know, good returns through multiple market cycles, and just anything you can share in that regard?
If you're an individual investor, obviously you want to have the capability and the ability to do the fundamental homework necessary to truly understand the business that you're investing in. And the only other piece of it, well, so if you don't have that ability and capability, then probably indexing it or finding a good manager, you know, that you philosophically agree with to manage your money is one tool that you can use. And then the other tool you can use is indexing if you don't want to take the time to, you know, do manager research, so to speak. And the only other piece of advice that I would give is to make sure that you live your life, again, with this term I used earlier, strong money. You know, you minimize the amount of debt that you have in your life. You spend less than you earn, and you always try to, you know, have the type of financial stability, safety, and financial strength to be able to not have to rely on other people during times of need.
I also wanted to see if you had any advice for financial advisors and asset allocators like myself, that a lot of the listeners are financial professionals. When they're analyzing investment managers like Artisan, it's difficult to assess how good of a manager are you without just being overly influenced by the returns. You can obviously look at managers who've had great returns, and whatever they say sounds like magic. And then there are managers who've gone through a stretch of underperformance, and whatever they say may not sound as attractive. Do you have any advice for allocators on my side of the table in getting a better sense of the alpha the manager actually has?
I think it's important to distinguish between, as I mentioned earlier, you know, what are products that are being sold and what managers you have access to that are, you know, in the business to create wealth and to improve purchasing power. I think that there's a major distinction between those two things. And then, you know, over and above, if you find somebody that you're interested in and you want to understand how to make some decisions that are simply outside performance, I think you have to look at the incentive structure under which that manager operates, you know, the amount of assets that they have. Are they open or closed? Is it small? Is it big? And look at their philosophy, make sure that it's consistent with, you know, the risk tolerance that you have internally. And then look at the discipline, and has it been executed consistently over time? And probably one of the most attractive things is you can find a very disciplined manager who's operating with the right incentive structure, who's gone through a bad patch, and that's probably a pretty good time to get involved.
That said like a true value investor.
I don't know how to do anything else.
Would you share any perspectives you'd like about today's market backdrop? I know you're a bottom-up stock picker, but are there any insights you can share about your top-down views?
Well, we're certainly not scraping along the bottom of a bear market, right? You know, things are pretty elevated. PE ratios are historically high. Interestingly, during a time period when interest rates are, you know, what I would consider within the realm of normal. So it's not a time period where you've got these very low interest rates that are justifying higher multiples. So there's a fair amount of enthusiasm in the market, and we can see it because the way that we assess the attractiveness of our portfolio is we measure an aggregate discount to intrinsic value. And so we have an intrinsic value estimate for every security in the portfolio. And then of course we have a market price, and there's a spread. And then for each security, and then we aggregate that up to an aggregate spread. And that spread, you know, we've tracked that every day since 2002, and that spread moves over time. And today we're at a relatively unattractive spread. And that reflects what we talked about earlier. The market's up a lot. You know, companies are hitting their estimates of intrinsic value faster than we can redeploy the cash. And as a result, we're in a time period where valuations just simply aren't that attractive. Now, that's our portfolio. You may find other managers who, you know, have, you know, a structure and have found securities that they think are very attractive at this point in time. But, you know, the way that I see it today for our portfolio in this market environment, you know, it's not obvious to me that, you know, there's a lot of opportunity out there.
Is that a bit surprising given the massive move in interest rates we had a couple of years ago and the economy's resiliency through that?
I've been completely surprised at how resilient things have been on such a significant move in interest rates off of a very extended time period from artificially low rates. It's been very surprising. Well, I think the boom associated with artificial intelligence is, you know, either portend validly the creation of a lot of value, or, you know, speculatively covered up for a little while, you know, what is likely to be a less robust economic time period. You know, one of the two.
Speaking internationally, Japan is an area that has been, until very recently, has had a bear market for decades. But the economy seems to be finally turning it around. How do you think about that region?
We were active investors for many, many years in Japan and, you know, spent years investing in companies at what I would say were some handout prices. And you could find some good businesses. They were few and far between. You know, they have terrible corporate governance issues in the way that their boards are structured. And there are all sorts of other cultural and legal issues in Japan that make commerce more difficult. But there was a prime minister several years ago who is now deceased, and his name was Shinzo Abe, who put in some structural reforms that have led to some improvements in corporate governance. There's also a resurgence in activism and private equity investment that have served to push companies to be more efficient. On the other hand, you know, some behavior by the Japanese government has pushed GDP per capita in Japan down to $37,000, roughly speaking, right? So that country is dependent on dollar-based, significantly dependent on dollar-based inputs, mainly for energy and for food. And the value of the yen, to pick up a random spot, 2011, during the tsunami, was 88 to the dollar. Now it's over 150, right? And so the GDP per capita in dollars has come down dramatically, and those consumers have to rely on dollar-based inputs. So the economy's not really growing. It's growing a little bit, but it's always grown a little bit. You know, in the 30 years that I've been doing this, but companies are getting more focused on improving profitability. And if you can find the right company at the right price that is on that trajectory, you know, it would be a good place to allocate capital, as long as you can defend yourself from further weakening of the yen.
And what about China? You know, second biggest economy in the world, but serious, you know, geopolitical concerns. How do you balance those two?
Yeah, well, while Japanese equities, especially the larger companies, are trading at multiples in the 20s, you can find a number of very good Chinese businesses that are trading at single-digit multiples with strong balance sheets and very commercially driven competitively driven management teams. It's a completely different world in China. So the geopolitical issues are there and they're very hard to handicap. Political outcomes, generally speaking, are very hard to handicap, but we think that there are attractive enough valuations for us to have a few very good investments.
Significant margin of safety. That's what you're talking about.
We can get a lot more excited about valuations in China than we can get about valuations in Japan. The skill level, the commercial orientation of Chinese management teams is on the other side of, you know, one side of a chasm is Japanese culture and management, and then the other side of the chasm is Chinese culture and management. And there's just geopolitical issues in the middle.
Well, David, I appreciate you sharing your insights with us today. I learned a lot, and I hope our listeners did as well. Thank you.
Alex, thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Please visit our website at insightfulinvestor.org to access past shows and learn more about our podcast. If you have questions, feel free to email us at info@insightfulinvestor.org. And if you enjoyed the discussion, please subscribe to this podcast to ensure you don't miss future episodes. And don't forget to forward today's conversation to others you think would enjoy listening. This podcast is provided for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as legal, business, investment, or tax advice. All opinions expressed by podcast participants are solely their own opinions and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Evoke Advisors, their affiliates, or companies featured. Due to industry regulations, participants on this podcast are instructed not to make specific trade recommendations, nor reference past or potential profits. And listeners are reminded that securities trading, commodity trading, and alternative investments are complex and carry a risk of substantial losses. As such, they are not suitable for all investors. Listeners should be aware that guests featured on the Insightful Investor may have current or past associations with Evoke Advisors or the host, including as an investment manager of a private fund opportunity by Evoke, or access through an affiliated Evoke fund, or as a client. Participation as a guest on the podcast should not be perceived as an endorsement or testimonial with respect to Evoke Advisors, the podcast host, or their services. Similarly, the inclusion of a guest on the podcast does not imply that Evoke Advisors or the host endorses the guest or any company with which they may be affiliated or employed. Evoke has neither paid nor received compensation from guests for their participation.